While sometimes death comes abruptly, we often have time to make decisions and come to terms with the end of life or the end of the life of a loved one. But that end-of-life experience can be very different depending on the conversations we've had with those loved ones and the healthcare professionals who may be involved. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The University of Wisconsin's Dr. Toby Campbell has devoted his work to making end-of-life care meaningful and appropriate for each individual patient. We're talking with great to have him with us today. And certainly, we're inviting you to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Have you talked about your end-of-life preferences with your loved ones? Or maybe you've had that conversation with a family member nearing the end of his or her life. I'd love to have you share your experiences, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Dr. Campbell, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
You're so welcome.
You specialize in palliative care, and let's define what that is for our listeners.
Sure. So I specialize in palliative care as well as oncology, and palliative care is a relatively new field of medicine, which is focused on providing an extra layer of support to patients and families who are facing a serious illness. We work together with the other doctors and clinicians who are taking care of that patient and family to add additional support regarding symptom management or decision making or anything that really is troubling or causing additional stress and burden during the time that they're facing that serious illness.
How does hospice care fit into that?
Hospice care is very much a part of palliative care. I would say that they are an incredibly important provider of palliative care, although specifically for people who meet the criteria that makes them eligible for hospice. So the main two barriers to being a hospice patient include having a serious illness, that two doctors need to certify you may have less than 6 months to live if all goes according to the normal course. And the second major barrier to hospice is that you need to be willing to, quote-unquote, forego life-prolonging treatment. Mm. So those two barriers keep a fair number of people out of hospice, but hospice is absolutely the gold standard for providing end-of-life care, particularly at the very end of life and particularly to people at home.
Yeah, absolutely. Who might be part? I think you kind of got mentioned most of them, but let's talk about who might be part of the team that can support a patient and their family toward the end of life.
Absolutely. In palliative care, we work in multidisciplinary teams, and the core components of our team include a physician, nurse, social worker, and spiritual support. And those are the fundamental elements of the team. Although we work with lots of others, when you think about hospice, we think about all the various needs and social support that exhausted and burdened caregivers have. That might include just having a break for a few hours. So yeah, Perhaps a volunteer or an aide can come to the house to provide a bath or just to sit with someone while you have a chance to, get a haircut.
Yeah.
You know, the things that just you lose when you are caring for someone all the time.
Go to a restaurant.
Yeah. Crazy stuff, eat.
Have a nice meal somewhere.
Right.
That you didn't make yourself.
Right.
Oh, man. So there are a lot of decisions that a family and a patient has to make, or at least think about as this time approaches, are there not?
Oh, there are so many things. And, you know, the element that we try to help with the most is those things that really, honestly, you don't want to think about. But in a facilitated way with someone who can coach you through these really important topics, you're ready to think about them. So, you know, big things like, well, do I have a set aside a decision maker? Who might speak for me if I'm in a position where I can't speak for myself? And boy, what would I want them to say? Well, how do you know what sorts of things to prepare them to talk about? You need sort of a guide to go through that process. What if you're facing a diagnosis that we know maybe we can slow things down, but we can't make it go away? Well, how do I begin to prepare myself and my family for what happens when I get sicker, when I'm physically more frail or psychologically or emotionally in a bind? And these are difficult conversations, but ones that we are expert in helping patients and families facilitate and think through.
I was thinking of a friend of mine who had diabetes and lost a foot, and then there was he was going to be losing the leg, and he finally just said, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to move on.
Yeah, there's a term that's usually either called clinical inertia or clinical momentum, and it refers to this idea that, particularly in hospitals, you get on the train with something with a lot of momentum, and we're all on it. The doctors are on it, the nurses are on it, the patient and family are on it. And a lot of things happen along that journey during hospitalization or in clinic as well that may or may not be the sorts of things that you would have wanted to happen if you'd really had a chance to pause, take a breath, and think about it. And I think to a degree, palliative care is existing within the healthcare system to try to make sure people are on the right train. You know, if more treatment is what you want, let me help you make sure you get it. But if, like your friend with diabetes, if less is actually what you want, let me do my best to try to help get you off the train or on a different train.
Yeah, he went on a different train and died, I think, a happier happier guy than another friend who was in the same boat, who went the other way and in the end lost his legs and an arm. And you know, I just sort of a piece-by-piece death, which was very, very sad.
Yeah, it is sad.
All the way around.
And in my experience, sometimes that's because we as a system haven't had the strength or clarity to have a frank discussion. And if I may say, to have a discussion that's done with really excellent communication at a high level. And that kind of consultation can really be helpful.
Our guest today, Dr. Toby Campbell, is a member of the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center. He's an assistant professor in medicine in the hematology-oncology section of UW School of Medicine and Public Health, where he's the chief of palliative care, the program. Great to have him along and certainly inviting your questions and comments. Gene in Lone Rock, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
My comments are that addressing these issues much earlier and on an ongoing basis, much in the ways that you don't have the sex talk with children anymore. It starts all the way through. My father-in-law died at 85, and my mother-in-law is 97 in an assisted living home. And when she was in her 80s and after he died, she didn't want to come and live with us, so we got her, went around and looked at apartments. But we did that while she was still competent to make those decisions. She stayed, you know, independent until that time came. But when she needed help, then we knew what her preferences were. It wasn't even a matter of end-of-life issues. It was cognitively choosing how she wanted to live her life.
Yeah,
and eventually she ended up requiring assisted living. And when her husband died, as you mentioned in the intro, when you go into a hospital, they're giving you these thick packets to talk about all of these kinds of decisions, and that's kind of fraught with urgency. The carryover on that can be if people don't do it while they're in for a short hospitalization and haven't finished it out. The rest of the family should pick up that stuff, and after the dust is settled from hospitalization, that you start talking about it. Often enough, older people say if something happens to, they can't say die or death for whatever reasons, but you kind of play that game. Well, what if something happened to you? How would you like it handled? And don't use the phrases that are.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Gene, for calling very much. I want to get Dr. Campbell's comments.
The reality is that most of us don't necessarily have a hospitalization to prompt these kinds of discussions. The Wisconsin Medical Society over the last couple of years has initiated a program they call Honoring Choices, based a lot on the work in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is the national standard for helping people define their advanced care plan in a prospective way earlier, when you're not facing any serious illness, maybe when you're in your 40s or 50s and there's nothing on the horizon. So the whole state, really, multiple different health centers across the state have picked up this Honoring Choices campaign and have moved forward with trying to help people set aside some time to clear up and provide direction to their loved ones about the kinds of things that they would want. So this is an interesting program that's out there in a lot of different communities.
And thank you again very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have with us today, Dr. Toby Campbell. He's featured in a documentary. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later on. It's going to be nationally aired. It's called Considered the Conversation, Two Stories About Cure, Relief, and Comfort. It's going to be shown on Wisconsin public television stations tomorrow. And certainly we're going to have him talk with us about the program. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And then we'll be back with Dr. Toby Campbell. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Back after the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about the end of life. It's a given for all of us, but how we are able to make that transition depends a lot on the conversations we have with our loved ones and with our healthcare professionals, and how peaceful we feel about decisions that we need to make. Really glad to have with us Dr. Toby Campbell, who is a member of the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center, assistant professor of medicine in the hematology oncology section of the UW School of Medicine Public Health, where he is the chief of the palliative care program. And Dr. Campbell, thank you again for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
How do you talk to patients? I was going to ask, I had a couple of questions for you, but you know what? We've got some people that have been waiting a long time. And so let's go there, and I'll come back to mine in a minute. Diana in Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I think what you said about communication is really important. We lost my mom in 1999, and we started talking as a family long before that, as far as just, you know, basic who wants what, but also what my parents' wishes were for their own end of life and their own, burials. And that was just really important to know what they wanted. And the other switch, my dad just passed in last December at 89. And I think the switch that we were seeing is that the doctors really start to help you recognize when enough is enough. You know, he had a pacemaker. He had medicines that weren't helping him, making him sicker. You know, his quality of life was deteriorating. And there was this big switch that I noticed, that the doctors were really there to help you decide it's time. And, they help turn off that shocking part of that pacemaker that, you know, when the heart slows down, it's rather uncomfortable. And, you know, he went into hospice so they could transition him off some of the medications that were helping to maintain life, to helping keep him comfortable. When he came home, they were there with, you know, hospital beds. They were there with everything. And, you know, it was just really nice to be able to have them say to us, this is okay. This is, you know, he's not going to live forever. This is okay. It's time to let's think about how to make him comfortable, honor his wishes, and move to those next steps. So thank you very much. I'll hang up now.
Thank you very much for calling, Diana. And that was a great call, wasn't it?
Diana, you know, you did a great job taking care of, sounds like, your mom and your dad. And I'm really touched by the differences that you noticed in the decade that passed between those two losses that you experienced. And I want to just highlight something we were mentioning earlier, Larry, that these are difficult conversations and ones you don't know how to have. And why would you? You need a guide and a facilitator. And it sounds like they had a good one who helped them through that and made it okay to do the right thing.
Yeah, that was great. I'm so happy for your family. Sean and Randolph, thank you for calling. Hello.
Well, thank you for the conversation, Larry and Dr. Campbell. I wanted to share, you know, a similar story, but very recently, actually from March to April, I lost one sister in March, and she had been staying at the Grace Hospice Center in Fitchburg, and that was one experience. And then we lost, as a family, another sister in April, and it was a very, very different, much more jarring experience. Two sisters, two different illnesses, because they were both ill, but because, as a family, we were able to gather around my sister Pamela and tell her how much we loved her, and there was a much deeper sense of closure. And with my sister that passed in May, it has been much more jarring, much more difficult collectively as a family, and I think in large measure because everybody knew she was sick, yet no one was able to let her know how much we loved her, and there was no sense of that closure. So a lot of the conversations and stories you're hearing are about aging parents, and been there, done that as well. But the conversation needs to be taking place for 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds,
right?
Everyday conversations, because I do believe strongly in the power of a vigil and the ancient honoring that represents for the life lived. And so I just think the whole hospice kind of world is just, it's profound.
Yeah. I want to give Dr. Campbell a chance to comment. Thank you so much, Sean, for calling.
Yes, thank you, Sean. Well, it is profound. I have the pleasure of working in a area of medicine where we have these kind of profound conversations every day, and it can really affect the way you think about life and how you feel at the end of the day when you're heading home. I know that the producers of the movie Consider the Conversation that Larry was mentioning would agree with you completely, Sean, that these are really impactful conversations that don't need to wait until you're facing the very end of life, that we should talk to our loved ones, talk to our doctors, when maybe even when there's nothing going on, but we just want to make sure we're all on the same page.
Yeah, and let's talk about the documentary. It's called Consider the Conversation 2, Stories About Cure, Relief, and Comfort. Tell us about it.
Well, the producers are Michael Bernhagen and Terry Caldusel, and they came to a lot of us across the country, it's probably been 2 years ago now, with an idea that they wanted to make a documentary about the importance of this patient-doctor communication. And they have done a really remarkably impressive job of pulling together the leaders in the field from across the country and the world, really, together with several examples of patients and families who are facing serious illness. And they've done some truly touching interviews with patients and families. They recorded several clinic visits with me and my patients. Several of those clinic visits seem to have made it into the movie. And it's just a really well-done story of what this can be like, but also where some of the trouble lies. I mean, there certainly are some stories in there that aren't the ideal. And so you have a chance to see the juxtaposition of good conversations and more, you know, ones that perhaps aren't ideal.
And we have it's going to be shown on public television stations actually across the nation tomorrow. And we have a link, I think, on our Facebook page. And you were telling me off air that it's not nominated for an Emmy.
Yeah, I just got an email late last night that they received word they had been nominated for an Emmy.
So obviously a very powerful film and really something well worth watching. I'm certain of that. Michael in Appleton, thanks a lot for calling. Hello.
Hello, Larry. A little bit earlier, you were mentioning the need for a guide and facilitator in palliative care, someone to help the family, help the patient work through all of this. Well, I'm wondering why we're talking about physicians in that regard and not social workers who are trained to provide counseling, medical social workers, if you will, who are really, as I say, trained in that profession and command an income of a third, a quarter, if you will, of physicians. You had a conversation, or at least Kathleen had a conversation yesterday about the costs of medical care and unnecessary work by people trained as physicians. And here we're talking about necessary work, but not necessary by someone who is trained as a physician.
I couldn't agree more, Michael. I think I mentioned earlier that we work in a team, and a social worker is one of the core members of our team. And I don't disagree with anything that you said. And actually, the truth is that your idea is what is in practice, that we work closely with social workers. There are some of these conversations that, honestly, a physician needs to conduct. For example, when you're telling someone that there isn't more treatment available, most people wouldn't accept that kind of conversation, even from a nurse practitioner. It really needs to be a physician. But a lot of these conversations can and should be conducted by non-physicians. I agree.
I want to ask you if I know in past years, and I've been told this by other doctors, that years back, when you were in medical school, you weren't getting any training at all in, or not you necessarily, but physicians weren't getting much training in this very thing.
Well, I certainly wasn't, and I think most of us aren't, and that's changing to a degree, although the most recent data that I've seen, surveys from American medical schools about the number of hours during the 4 years of medical school that are devoted towards communication or to palliative care training, the national mean is still somewhere between 1 and 2 hours in the 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
There are some institutions, ours included, that spend considerably more time, but it's really isolated to places that have someone like myself and my colleagues who actually, I don't lead the medical student education at our institution, a woman named Ann Curtis does, but you know, we have people here who are dedicated to that, and there are certain other med schools that do, but most med schools do not. It's coming, but.
Michael, thanks again for calling from Appleton. Michael in Wauwatosa, I'd like to give you a chance. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm going through this right now, so it's very fresh. And what I found is the disconnect between the hospital and the hospice. I mean, they're in the same building, but it's like they don't know each other. There's no communication between them. It was very hard to get my sister into the hospice. It was very hard to get the doctor to say that she should go there. Doctors need to tell people that, you know, the person is passing away and there's nothing really to do.
Yeah.
You know, Michael, I think that it's a story that I hear too often. And when I was relaying that sort of metaphor, if you will, about the clinical inertia and the momentum, this sort of train that keeps moving, sometimes, you know, it's hard for the doctors to suggest that we get off the train. And I think when we're working well in our palliative care team, part of what we're doing is actually supporting the doctors as well to say to them, just like we heard from the caller earlier, hey, this is okay. You know, sometimes they know it inside, but they haven't yet got to that conclusion themselves. And sometimes we can help them be okay and really sort of acknowledge that this is what's happening. The poor communication is hard to hear, too. That's a reality in every part of our healthcare system and just a fact that needs to be improved upon unequivocally. And boy, what a stressful time to have poor communication,
yeah.
You know.
It's probably the worst time almost to have it. Michael, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. I'm sorry it turned out the way it did. Jerome in Mequon, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes, I'm a caller with a question. My question is, how can I obtain a book and or publications on this important and personal subject?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the question would be, you know, books which are geared towards lay audiences opposed to medical audiences. There are several authors who have written books which are relatively approachable from a lay perspective. Although what's interesting to me is that one author I would point out, for example, who's written a few powerful books for me is a physician named Ira Byock. Ira wrote a book called Dying Well, which really is touching. He wrote another one called The Four Things That Matter Most, which is really touching. And that would be a good place, I think, to start your literature search. Some of these books are hard to write, and they're hard to read. And, yeah. You know, it's a careful dance, I think, for authors to talk in an honest way about end of life while still finding a readership that you know, is ready for it.
And his name again is?
Ira Byock, B-Y-O-C-K.
B-Y-O-C-K, okay. And the two book titles again were?
One of them is called Dying Well, and his other one is called The Four Things That Matter Most.
And what about hospitals themselves? Could you, or your own doctor, your own physician, ask, are there materials that the hospital or that the physicians typically would hand out?
We may have some, or we may have a resource list. For example, we have a resource list for people who have young children, for example. And we have resource books that are geared towards children of different ages that you either read to your child, or perhaps you might have your child read if they're at a reading age. So we have resources like that. I don't have a lot of books on hand to give to people, although we do have some lists that we might provide.
Margie in Milwaukee, thanks a lot for calling. Hello.
Hi, thanks for this important topic. And I just wanted to point out that I had been at the Oconomowoc Performing Arts when they showed Consider the Conversation, the original one, a few years ago, and it was magnificent. And I met Michael and Terry, the ones that produced it at that time, and they said that they were going to be working on this second one regarding the doctor's point of view and from the medical perspective versus the family. And I think the important thing is realizing the title, Consider the Conversation, because it's so hard just to get people to think about it. And I highly recommend people watching it tomorrow and starting a conversation with people. And regarding the gentleman that called before about wanting information or books, if he goes to the website, Consider the Conversation, he can actually order the documentary, the DVD, and I bought it, and she can have shared it with family members. And I'm assuming that this one coming out might be available in that way, too. Also, Maria Shriver actually wrote a book called What's Happening to Grandpa, and it's a beautiful story about losing your grandfather to Alzheimer's and not understanding what's going on. And I have another book on my shelf called Handbook for Mortals, Guidance for People Facing Serious Illness. It's an older book from 99, but it goes into a lot of how the family can work together. And there are resources out there.
Yeah, yes, there are. Dr. Campbell?
Yeah, I've reviewed Handbook for Mortals. I haven't read Maria Shriver's book, but thank you for the call. Some good resources for people to consider.
You created the We Talk workshops for healthcare providers to teach them how to talk with patients who are dealing with end-of-life issues. What do you cover in those?
Larry, I am so passionate about high-quality communication. And I'm talking about the kind of communication that happens between two individuals sitting in a clinic room or in a hospital room. We as doctors and providers, I should say, social workers and nurses, all of us, we as clinicians should have the skill set necessary to do these difficult conversations really, really well. So what We Talk is designed to do is to put clinicians through simulated situations with, we rely heavily on actors and essentially improvisational theater for our clinicians to deliver serious news to people in a realistic setting. And then what we use are, there was a theorist named Augusto Boal who developed this sort of participatory theater and what he called theater of the oppressed. And he talked about how if you pause the action and move the fourth wall, which is typically that sort of invisible barrier between the audience and the actors, so you're not supposed to be able to see each other. Of course you can, but we're pretending we can't. So what we can do in these simulated situations is move that fourth wall so that the doctor and the observers in the room can talk. And we can talk about what's going on in that dynamic with the patient in real time. And then we can move the fourth wall back and the doctor and patient can engage again. Sometimes we rewind and try again and rewind and try again until we've reached a new skill, until we've helped them to develop something new, try something new, experiment. And, you know, I am just a believer that communication is a skill, emphasis on the word skill. And to gain new skill, you have to practice, right? I couldn't tell you how to ski and have you know how to do it. You have to practice it.
I think you're absolutely right. I've had a really great experience. My wife and I, this was probably 12 years ago, and we found out our daughter was not going to live. And the doctor who explained it was absolutely wonderful. It was a great, I'm almost tear up to think about it right now. It was a great, a terrible thing to happen, but a great experience in the way he was able to explain it to us.
You know, I would expect that when facing something awful like that, you shouldn't add to that poor communication in the way in which it's explained. I'm glad that you had a good experience, and I think that we should all expect that. And so I think I want to keep working to help the clinician side of things be able to do that well, expertly.
Carolyn Mekwan, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to give a little bit more information to the caller who requested, some resources for lay people to look at in terms of having the conversation. And the approach that I come from is that I'm an elder law attorney, so I work with clients on a daily basis, setting up the legal advance directives that put their healthcare decisions into legal form. And as we go through and execute these legal forms for clients, the last thing that I say to them after we sign the documents is, now these really mean nothing unless you have the conversation with your family about your preferences and have the conversations with your healthcare agents. So, you know, they always ask me, well, where can we go to get some information on this? And I'm in the car, so I'm going to give you my best guess on the answer to these questions. But one really great lighthearted book is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And it's a book about a family that went through this, you know, discussion where the family didn't really want to talk about the end-of-life issues, but, but the main character kept pushing the issue. And so it's a really good book for people to read. But some other really good resources are a website that's called caringconversations.org.
Sharingconversations.org. We can post that up on my Facebook page if that's do you know that one, Dr. Campbell?
I don't.
You might want to test it because, again, I'm calling from the car.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. I hope, Carol, when you get home or get near your computer, that you'll finish the recommendations posted on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post those up. Thank you so much, and Dr. Campbell, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the movie tomorrow night on Wisconsin Public Television.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We'll talk with him again about options for end-of-life care. It was a great conversation, and thanks for all the wonderful questions and the sharing of experiences. I really appreciate it. Lisa Johnson joins me tomorrow on the Ideas Net. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us.